Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. They got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty does absolutely work for you. And I want to take a moment to apologize to you for the way the show ended last week and that we were really rushed. Just a lot that was, you know, trying to compress in. And as you well know, is that every week I have so much information that I try to bring to you that, I just run out of time. Well, this week I'm going to pre-announce that next week is going to be very exciting and that we're going to have Dan Johnson on from the Tax Revolution Institute. Pretty excited about that, to see what Dan has, as we're talking about the tax transitions of what's going to occur based on what this administration is talking about, and maybe some kind of radical ideas coming out of Dan, and maybe not. Maybe some sensible ideas that have more constitutional formation to them on how we should be taxed as a people. And how do we support our government in a constitutional manner? So I'm pretty charged about where that's going to go when we have Dan here next week. Now, the interesting thing that I am really looking at today is to follow up with last week. And I have to start the program out, though, is that I'm getting more and more frustrated with the likes of Sean Hannity and others in the, I guess you can call them the conservative media, because, you know, if you look at my book, Not All Conservatives Are Constitutionalists, you can clearly understand that your definition on this program and on this network of what a conservative might be obviously does not hold candle to what is necessarily out there, even on the Fox News or some of the other blogs. My perspective is that I'm a constitutionalist with the anti-federalist bent, if you will. And I look at the world from that perspective. And with that, it's bothersome to me in particular that we hear this term snowflakes being used for those that are running around in rampage, either on the campuses, on the streets, in the media, or even in the corporate world. I take umbrage to that on several points. And I brought it out in a few weeks ago. I said that I'm really tired of hearing these people being described as snowflakes, because I go back to the biblical reference of being washed as white as snow when one is come into a total understanding of what the biblical truth is on salvation. We know politics isn't going to save anybody. We know politics does not save a nation. And quite frankly, as I've been studying more through the Old Testament, it is absolutely, in my opinion, that God does control every aspect of a life and a political well-being, although we participate in that, and we participate on whether we choose good or evil. So calling what I will determine and say very, very clearly that these people that are engaged in the COSAC plan, which I brought out in other programs in January, and engaged in these Marxist activities, because what we're seeing now with the rampages on the streets are in fact Marxist activities supported by Marxist entities. So they're not snowflakes. And by calling them snowflakes, I think is, number one, it's a violation of my conscience. And number two, can I say that? I think that's kind of interesting. It's a violation of my conscience that they would be called snowflakes. No, because they're evil, okay? They are people that are anti-American. They do not understand the terms of which they use in language. As, for instance, on Thursday, the counter things that were going on in Berkeley, the anti-American side was calling everything else fascist and a fascist government. Well, you know, I've used that in the sense that it has been because of legislation, because of treaties, because of the socialist input into our structure of law and governance, and how that is instituted into business. Yes, that comes into a greater definition of fascism. The actions, and these actions both in the media as well as in these people on campuses, professors, and in business that are reacting to what we're seeing in governance now, is not fascism. They're Marxists, okay? And we need to understand the definition of the terms. And so we're going to kind of go through maybe not all of that, but I do want to pick up shortly where I left off in talking about the transition of actions and activities during the Reagan administration and what that means for us today within the context of the Trump administration, and then go back in history. But I want to start out with going back in history. I want to start out where I brought in that old friend of mine from the 1800s, Alex de Tocqueville. And it was interesting is that I took you through his famous commentary that a lot of people quote, that you know, what we see is that in a republic as ours, and de Tocqueville looks at it as a democratic republic because of a lot of governance being at the local level, but yet on the national level, it's very clear that we should be functioning in a federalist perspective, meaning that the states have the larger control of power and not the centralized government. But almost immediately after, and let me remind you what he talks about, and I think is a great example, or actually the predictive definition of the majority of the voting public in America today. So what he was talking about in this goes to this. After having thus successfully taken each member of the community in his powerful grasp and fashioned them at will, the supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community. And, you know, that's what we're seeing in the universities and what we've created, okay, is that what we have seen is the Marxists, the Gramsciites, the Alinskyites, the socialists, the little commies running around in the 60s that are in the universities have taken each member of the community in their powerful grasp, and now they've fashioned them all the way down into the high schools and the middle schools. So that's why the Sam Adams Center for Political Science, sacps.org, is very, very critical to get back with our youth. Now, the idea that he continues is that it covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, through which the most original minds and the most energetic characters penetrate, to rise above the crowd. So, you know, what we've seen that is that we've seen with overregulation, we've seen what's come out, we've seen all of this social justice insanity. I mean, this is, he's describing all of that. He goes on, the will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses. It weakens, fatigues, or exhausts. It extinguishes and stupefies the people, till each nation is reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals of which the government is the shepherd. Now, you know, that I think that is pretty much highlights what we've been seeing in the media, the Berkeley issue, many of the others, the overwhelming insanity of tolerance, the stupidity of Chelsea Clinton talking about that genitalia, you know, the nastiness that the Muslims do, not to use that because it's offensive and all of these different types of things. Toleration, all of that, it forces people, it forces us. It doesn't weaken in so many regards. It doesn't tyrannize, but it compresses, weakens, fatigues, exhausts, extinguishes, stupefies. You know, that's what's all going on. And what they want is everybody to be that. They want us to be sheeple. They want us to be that timid, industrious. Got to be industrious, got to improve economy, got to do all of that. But yet they want to be that shepherd and lord over us and bring us into the servitude so that he says that it's a servitude of the regular, quiet, and gentle kind, which he just described as, you know, being a sheeple, if you will. And that it takes, and it really, you know, has this odd form of freedom. You know, and that's where we go now with the sovereignty of the people. So where I want to go with this real quickly in these last few minutes is that he really describes what happens, and there's a lot to it here. He says, I do not, however, deny that a constitution of this kind, being the kind in the United States, appears to me to be infinitely preferable to one which, after having concentrated all the power of the government, should vest them in the hands of irresponsible person or a body of persons. What we have seen and what the anti-federalists have always been concerned about, were concerned about, and I am still today, is what we have now, especially under the last number of administrations, was a centralized government. They feared that. They said that's what would happen under the Constitution of 87, and I continuously show you how that has happened. Now, this is what's freaking everybody out, and the Marxists, Gramsciite, Alinskyites are really going crazy over, and that's why the Marxists are out on the streets in force, is because we are now, under the Trump administration, not that it's perfect, is chipping away at that centralized government and trying to return us to some sensibility of federalism. Federalism being what was originally intended or supposed to work under that concept with the Bill of Rights is that the states are the central force and the people are the total sovereignty and not the federal government. To that end, he continues on, let's see here where I leave off, all the forms which democratic despotism could assume, the latter would assuredly be the worse. And that's what we see, is that under a centralized constitutional environment, you have that, what I've called over and over, a democratic despotism. When the sovereign is elective or narrowly watched by a legislature, which is really elective and independent, the oppression which he exercises over individuals is somewhat greater. But it is always less degrading because every man, when he is oppressed and disarmed, may still imagine that whilst he yields obedience, it is to himself he yields it, and that it is to one of his own inclinations that all the rest give way. Ladies and gentlemen, this is critical as we come to pretty much a close of this last segment. And this is the American people being fooled, the American people being caught up in this idea that we elect these powers, whether it's at the state or at the national level, and yet they're despots. I've called that in so many different ways because of what we've allowed to happen in that greater perspective. And here's my friend de Tocqueville predicting this. And he says more, and I really don't have the time to get into them more. But he predicted this back in the 1850s as what would happen and could happen within our form of constitutional environment, being it much better than anywhere else in the world. So ladies and gentlemen, as we come back, we're going to talk about some real-time issues relative to this and what happened during the Reagan era. And I'm going to fall back into that with you. as we come back to Samuel Adams. Yes, he's returned, and the Anti-Federalists, yes, they did. They absolutely got it right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalists. Yes, they absolutely got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty works for you. And I do appreciate that you support this network and that you participate in it, that you check out the other hosts and hostesses, and during the week, even listen to the live programming in your market area. There's a lot of good stuff happening here at Liberty Works Radio Network, and I have to say that the father of the network, if you will, is John Cottomer, and he's been doing a great job of recovering from an illness over the last several months. And John, we're delighted that you are back on that road of recovery, and we just thank you for your vision, and thank you for everything that you've been doing to ensure that this network and liberty is something that stands strong for today and for our posterity. So, ladies and gentlemen, as you can, I continue to ask you to support the network, since it is a listener-funded network, and I appreciate everything that John and Dick and the whole crew have done, as well as all the other numbers of hosts and hostesses that are on this network. So, the interesting thing that when we look at Liberty Works Radio Network, we go back to de Tocqueville just for a quick moment, in that whole section that I was just reading to you and talking to you about in the last segment. One of the things that he drives through again, and I'm going to just kind of summarize it for you, is that, you know, and it is right that at the national level, and as the founders intended, there's certain things that we give up in sovereignty. There's certain things that we say, okay, Mr. President, you and your cabinet and Congress, you take care of these different things that are out there. But you know what? When it gets down to what I'm going to barbecue on the grill, how I'm going to flush my toilet, how I'm going to use my water, when it gets down to how I'm going to breathe my air, how I'm going to drive the car I want to drive, how it's going to be the toiletries that I want to use, so on and so forth, when it gets down into those minute areas, get out of my life. Get away. You don't belong here. How I'm going to raise my children, get out. You don't belong in the schools, federal government. And we see a lot of that happening. And de Tocqueville brought that out in a very interesting way. Is that what he was saying is that when things are centralized, what it may produce is, you know, some diminished evil, but at the same time it doesn't get rid of it. And that it leaves a lot of room for the intervention of individuals in the important affairs, but it is less suppressed in the smaller and more private ones. And that's where you have to pay attention as well. You know, but in the fact is that it allows for especially a dangerous enslavement of mankind, which we're seeing by all of the various regulations that are out there. And then we see that even in the larger political circle that I'm going to talk about in just a moment. But you know what? When we have these things coming in to the small aspects of life, the minor affairs, that affects the whole community. It doesn't drive to resistance, but it crosses them in every turn till they are led to surrender the exercise of their will. And that's what we have in so many different ways, and all of this tolerance and all these minute regulations. Hey, can you rent a lawnmower in California? Can you barbecue? Can you use your wood stove to heat your house? That's the type of stuff that he was talking about. And thus it takes and enslaves the people, and it takes and forces a surrender of the will, and until your spirit is gradually broken and the character is, it's gutted out. Whereas obedience, which is exacted on a few important but rare occasions, you know, it kind of leaves you out. And that's what we expected. That's what the Constitution was all about, was that there were certain limited powers that are out there. But you know what? We're going to kind of move from those limited powers. And I want to say something that just going back is all part of that. You know what? Get out of our lives. That's exactly what federalism is all about, that the states and the local governments are primary and closest to the people, and that the federal government was limited in what its authority and powers were. So we need to take apart a lot of these different bureaucratic organizations because they don't belong there. But one of the things that I wanted to bring all of this around to is because policy matters. And that's the reason for SACPS.org, is because what we want is to be able to bring our youth back to a founder's understanding of what it means to, number one, derive policy, and number two, exercise it in a meaningful way at the appropriate level of governance, so that government then is maintained only for that area which society deems it necessary. Now, John Stormer, actually in None Dare Call It Treason 25 years later, talking about the treaty traps and what happened during the Reagan administration, which I started last week and I'm going to finish up in this segment, is that people are policy, he writes. And why that's important is because we're seeing that in every aspect, not only of this administration, but in every past administration, is that the people that were in the different bureaucratic components, regardless of the president, their policy actions and the things they did according to their worldview, that's what matters. And it's people. It's people from their worldview. So again, that's why SACPS is so important, because we have to have our youth understanding foundational founders' intent, original intent for a worldview of what this nation is supposed to be, so we can maintain the nation in a form of liberty. Now, what was interesting is that I take you back, is that when we saw that the Iran-Contra component of things started going crazy, and the leftists went even crazier, that John Poindexter was thrown out, as well as Oliver North, and Frank Carlucci was appointed. Carlucci comes in, and within 90 days, he gets rid of everybody that had strong anti-communist perspective. That's very, very important, because otherwise, because Reagan was very strong anti-communist. Poindexter, Ollie North, a whole number of people, Frank Gaffney, so on and so forth, Gene Kirkpatrick. And here comes Carlucci, and I'm going to tell you about him real quick because it is about people. He whacks everybody out. And then next thing you know is Carlucci takes and goes into SecDef, after he left the National Security Council and cleaned house there and brought in more soft Soviet ideology, that things changed in how even Reagan was taking and doing, going to do treaty. Now, the interesting thing is that you had a lowlife that was a friend of Nancy Reagan and an advisor, Mike Deaver, and I always thought Deaver was devious and a lowlife. He told the likes of Gene Kirkpatrick, a very strong Reagan person, anti-communist, he goes, you know, the president may have an opportunity to make peace. Kirkpatrick goes, wonderful, I can't wait. But after going through to dinner and everything like that, he being Deaver, basically says that when the time comes that the president has the opportunity to make peace, we can't have you and Bill Clark around raising questions. That's what he said to Gene Kirkpatrick. And basically, it was, you know, what was going on with that? Kirkpatrick writes a whole essay about that in a writing that she did. But the whole piece of it was, is that Kirkpatrick, William Clark, and all of the others were ousted so that the INF treaty could go in without the verifications that we Reagan wanted to have initially. People matter. So, you know, you start looking at who was this guy, you know, that this Clark, I mean, this Carlucci, a longtime bureaucrat. He was repeatedly given assignments in some part of the world's most crucial trouble spots. And Carlucci was there on the scene again and again when freedom forces were crushed and international communism gained victories. Wow, what does that say about this guy? He was a State Department officer in the Congo in the 1960 through 64 when the U.S. and U.N. Crushed the pro-Western free enterprise Christian leadership of Mose Tombi in the Katanga province. And the communists took over. The Cuban-led communists took over the Congo. Carlucci was there and allowed it to happen. He's the one that allowed that stuff to go on. Then it goes on that he was in the Office of Economic Opportunity and Department of Health and Education in the Nixon administration. He was assigned to other key areas in conflict, especially in Portugal, and he was the one that forced the hand of Portugal to turn over Angola. And there again, Castro walked into Angola and took over that, and we still have that battle going on. Carlucci took and then ended up in the Carter administration. He was named the Director of Central Intelligence in 78. He was the Deputy Director. And during his four-year tour as number two in the CIA, that's when we lost Iran and Nicaragua. Jeez, what's up with this guy, you know? And then in 87, you know, it was Jimmy Carter. He takes and he's the deputy CIA director, and then he goes into President Reagan's national security advisor, purging all of the hardliners and against communism. And then, you know, Carlucci makes his way all the way through and into when he goes into the Department of Defense as the head of that. Then he takes and whacks out all of the anti-communist people and changes policy to the extent that you can't even talk about communism, and takes it out of training manuals. He does a lot of things no different than Obama did when it comes to radical Islam and all of that, as these people are pro. So what's a lot of the results is that in 78, the chief of the Soviet General Staff, Marshal Obrukhov, told Congressman Breckinridge that, "Today, the Soviet Union has military superiority over the United States, and henceforth the U.S. will be threatened. You had better get used to it." Now, that is interesting. And tragically, it's been something we've had to deal with constantly, is that the Communist Party in 1961 actually wrote this on negotiations. And you have to understand, when we look at the bad negotiations, you know, Trump was absolutely correct. It wasn't that people were incompetent. It was that they were incompetent because they didn't read what the enemy was all about and talk about that. Because here, when we look at the bad deals we got in all of the treaties on nuclear weapons, including what's happened with China and North Korea, and especially with Iran now, here's how it is with the Communist Party wrote this in 1961. "The chief aim of the foreign policy of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union is to ensure peaceful conditions for the building of a communist society in the USSR and the development of a world system of socialism." So why did they lie? Why did they cheat? Why do they do all of the things they do in treaties? Because they don't negotiate from the same perspective. They actually wrote that to negotiate, and this was back all the way in 59, was that in the present century, the Soviet state has perfected the use of negotiation, including negotiation by mass conference, as a method of warfare. And they write about that, the communists, as well as what we see in all of the Islamist area. They use negotiation as a form of warfare, especially against America. So once again, this is where Donald Trump, I think, is going to be very, very interesting in his art of the deal, because he's a pretty hard-nosed negotiator, and he's expecting that out of the people, especially out of Tillerson. So negotiation, very critical. People are policy. And that's why we're promoting Samuel Adams Center for Political Science, to help our youth understand what it means as people who derive policy. Come on back in the next segment, and we'll talk about that a little bit more and get into some of our Founding Fathers' writings relative to all of this here on Liberty Works Radio Network. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. Yep, they always got it right, without any question in my mind. And what we're finishing up with is talking about people matter because they drive policy. And I want to take a step back on that one. I think last segment we talked about it very interestingly. We saw, you know, what Carlucci did in the shifts in what would happen in the Reagan White House from a strong anti-communist perspective that took and then loosened it up in such a way under a pro-communist, I'll call Carlucci pro-communist. I don't know whether he was a communist, but he definitely was a sympathizer by virtue of taking and allowing, you know, the types of treaties, negotiations, and cleaning house in every place that he touched relative to, anyway, you know, you got to read his record, and the guy says he was for peace, but in actuality, what he did is he allowed communists to take over more and more, especially of Africa. And treaty-wise, they actually kicked our butts when it came to developing treaties. We've seen that also with Kerry, you know, in their Secretary of State, and obviously Hillary Clinton, and all of the, you know, all of the evil that is allowed to be perpetrated on America under the guise of all these terminology, and insanities, without looking at foundational principles. So that gets us to that whole piece of people and policy matters, because people will drive policy based on their worldview. I want to take a little bit of a step back with that, is that with the Samuel Adams Center for Political Science, the aspect of why we look at the worldview and why we want the students in the youth to understand our constitutional form of original intent is because policy matters. And it matters all the way into what happens in family life, what goes on in your home. You know, you as a parent, or you even if you're a single person, you set policy inside your home. Who enters, who leaves, how they leave, what they do when they come in your house, how they sit down, you know, what do you do? You're going to have meals. This is the rules of your home. You're establishing policy. You're establishing rules. You're establishing procedures. So you're doing policy all your life. And that's part of what we really want to do, is to take and help people understand that life skills, politics is everywhere. It's everywhere in life. And how does that then make its, you know, transition, or how does it become even more extensible into society? So if you can handle what that means and what our founders intended for a self-governing people, that means you have to be able to govern yourself. You have to be able to govern yourself within your house, whether anybody's there or not. So those are some of the things that we have to understand, again, that the founders intended, that you can't govern outside if you can't govern inside. So that was the whole idea of morality. That was the whole idea of public and private virtue. That was a number of the aspects that our founders intended to develop this nation. So let me see here. I wanted to bring you some things that were real interesting that kind of relate to all of that. I'm going back to Volume 1 of the Founders' Constitution. As I mentioned before, there's only 5 volumes to this, and it has all of our founders' historical intent and writings and all of the conceptual stuff on, you know, how they derived their ideas, or how we can understand the derived ideas, those foundational truths and intents, because it's not just from a simple whimsical interpretation of a Harvard lawyer. Did I say that right? Most of those people coming out of Harvard are liars. anymore. They're not the Samuel Adams type of people coming out of any of the Ivy League schools, or most universities we know have all of the socialist Marxists that have taken them over. One of the things that was very interesting to me at the beginning was within here. I mean, you don't have to go far into this to find a lot of meat that matters. And I got to take you back, and it's way too long to actually try and get into the whole heart of it. But I was impressed to find that there was another Cato before the writings of Samuel Adams as Cato. And actually, this guy wrote a year before Sam Adams was born. In 1721, he wrote the letter Cato. And this was Thomas Gordon. Thomas Gordon wrote this on 22 July, and it was called The Right and Capacity of the People to Judge of Government. And he really goes through the whole process of what was going on during that period of time in the colonies, and that, you know, we have to look at it. What is the whole aspect of governance? But trust is one thing. What is government but a trust committed by all or the most to one or a few who are to attend upon the affairs of all? Interesting. Then he talks about something that is there, and what is that trust? How is it exercised? As to the refinements and the finesse, they are often only the false appearances of wisdom in parts, and oftener tricks to hide the guilt and emptiness of those that are dishonest in government and use the arts of a jobber in politics. Now, you know, at that time, we continue to see, and this is because it drives that whole concept that people drive policy. And what is it in the magistrates? What are the enemies of the people? How does that come about? Public enemies have been the same individual men. Wow, isn't that interesting? You know, there's been at times and countries when public ministers and public enemies have been the same. What a melancholy reflection is this, that the most terrible and mischievous foes to a nation should be its own magistrates. Well, we see that over and over. We've seen that over and over. So, you know, where is the morality in men? And even in business, you know, not just in governance. Ladies and gentlemen, this is one of the things, again, that SACPS.org brings to bear, is that policy matters, and having foundational understanding intent does deal with morality and virtue. And what does that mean in the business environment? And clearly, you know, economy is not the same as liberty, and to the extent that economy has overshadowed liberty in so many different ways. And so he continues on and talks about this whole aspect of one man or a few have often pretended the public and meant themselves and consulted their own personal interests in the instances essential to its well-being, but the public and act for the public by acting for themselves. This is particularly the spirit of our Constitution, and meaning then the English Constitution, in which the whole nation is represented, and our records afford instances where the House of Commons have declined entering upon the question of importance till they had gone into the country and consulted their principals, the people. So what he's talking about also in this Cato letter is the fact that we have that isolation, and we've seen the isolation in the political environment. For instance, Paul Ryan has no idea of the truth of America. He has no idea of what it means to be a constitutional republic, and he has no idea of what it is that Mr. Trump went out and found out that the people are all about, and what is America. And the Marxist Gramsciite socialists don't care. And so you have the whole Democrat Party out there that is absolutely out of any sense of reality, especially with middle America, except for where they have perpetrated and purposefully designed and developed their Marxist institutions within academia and within the large urban areas, and created and facilitated such that those who would be the citizens are captives, are enslaved by ideology. So this is what we are talking about, what Cato was talking about, or actually Thomas Gordon was talking about relative to the people. And the real-time example of that, if you don't get to your constituency, guess what? You're isolated, and then it's all about you. And that's some of the things that he was talking, he's just very, very clear on. So he was saying here, in truth, our whole worldly happiness and misery, abating for accidents and diseases, are owning to the order or mismanagement of government. And he who says that private men have no concern with government does wisely and modestly tell us that men have no concern in that which concerns them most. It is saying that the people ought not to concern themselves whether they be naked or clothed, fed or starved, deceived or instructed, and whether they be protected or destroyed. What nonsense and servitude in a free and wise nation. Boy, he's just like talking today. No different than what we see today. They want us to shut up. They being the Alinskyites, the Gramsciites, the Marxists, I guess the Hannity and all of them call them the left, but let's really call them what they are. But they want you to shut up. They want you to be shepherded, as de Tocqueville says. They want you to take and have no concern, because they said they'll take care of you. But more importantly, that if you raise a ruckus, who cares? You're nothing. And that is not what our free society is about. It's nonsense and servitude. Really? Is that what we want? Here it is, 1721. And I can't even get you to the whole idea yet of what Sam Adams has to say about it. But, you know, he goes on. He says, for myself, you know, he's thought pretty much about this. And he has a real opinion about it. And in general, it is certain that one man and several men may be bribed into the interest opposite to that of the public, but it is as certain that a whole country can never find the equivalent for itself, and consequently a whole country can never be bribed. Now that's interesting when we look at the Trump phenomena. The Trump phenomena in the respect that the whole country can't be bribed. You can have those various sections, as we've already identified, especially in the urban areas, where the Marxist, Alinskyite, Gramsciite, socialist whole ideology can take and have a deep-seated environment. But when you go across the rest of the nation, what is there? There is what I've always called the American DNA. But you know what? That American DNA goes all the way back to 1721 and this Cato letter by, yes, none other than Thomas Gordon. We're not going to even get to Sam Adams. But the whole point of it is that you can't bribe a whole nation. There's a lot of people that have been bribed, and we've seen that the Democrats do most of what they do and take us into that servitude and slavery by a form of government bribery. And it's amazing is that we as those that understand true liberty don't want that. And we'll have to close up that it comes under our whole Bill of Rights. And we have to stand strong and understand that we have, even as the anti-federalist mentioned, there's a lot of holes in this Constitution. The fact is that we have to be able to build it up, facilitate it to success, ensure that our republic stands strong by virtue of developing our youth again. We have to take our youth back. They have been and continue to be destroyed. And I have to say, getting education back to local people is important, but we have to help those local people understand what Founders' intent is for our republic. So that's important. And once again, I ask you to go check out the Samuel Adams Center for Political Science, sacps.org, and come on back next week when we get into the Tax Revolution Institute with Dan Johnson and what he has to say about taxation for today. Thanks a lot, and come on back next week.